The sanitized version, sorry. There may be a few cuss words. But they sound much better with an English accent. Welcome, welcome. I am a very grateful member of ACA, and I am, despite the accent, in California. I'm down in Los Angeles. I know some of you guys are up in Marin County. When I first came to America, I was 23. I came as a journalist to visit the first and I think last California Prune Festival up in Sacramento, and I was explained that BMW meant basic Marin wheels, and I was introduced to the Bay Area, and I thought, well, I'm going to come back and live here. Anyway, that didn't happen, but it's nice to be back in spirit. So my recovery story, buckle up, we'll do the full thing. So as you can tell, I grew up in London and moved to Los Angeles when I was 30, and when I first moved to LA, I was in a little teeny apartment in West Hollywood where, actors and everyone passing through, changing their name, trying to become someone else. And but they all would go to these mysterious 12-step meetings, anything with an A on the end, NA, CAA, and so on. Never heard of any of this. And but I was the only one in the building who had a car, a little VW, so I would take them to their meetings, and sit at the back and hear the stories, AA stories, NA stories, and so on. And they had some great speakers, doing 45-minute lead shares like me. And and so I was really fascinated by this, world of recovery and sharing your feelings and things. It just wasn't my story. I didn't have an AA or an NA story. I hadn't stolen a tank. I hadn't married three strippers in one night. I didn't go on a meth run armed to the teeth with someone I'd never met before. All those great escapade stories, not my story. So I was like, okay, time to move on. And so my recovery sort of story starts about 7 years later. Married, bought this house, and it was my brother was the sort of catalyst for getting me into the first step of recovery. And I think, like a lot of people, I got in through Al-Anon before finding my way to ACA, because ACA, is the finishing school of recovery. We are where everyone ultimately winds up. You can get clean and sober, and then realize it didn't fix everything, and then you kind of keep going until you find ACA. And I feel like we're the bottom of the Freudian the pyramid, where it all begins. My brother, his younger brother, and like the dysfunctional families, as I learned, we all played our different roles to survive. So my older sister was the perfectionist, the rescuer, the sort of perfect grown up. I oscillated between the mascot, trying to keep it all jolly, and then the lost child. That was the sort of binary role play. And then my brother was the younger brother was the black sheep, a lot of energy and booming voice, and boy could he drink. And so when he was in the army, it was contained. He would only drink when he was on leave. The problem was he would come and stay at my little apartment in London, and within 2 days this was trashed. And I remember once having I got a sort of a commemorative set of really fancy rum, and I thought, well, this will be my centerpiece decoration in my bachelor pad for at least 10 years. Look at this. It was like eight bottles or something. Anyway, one weekend I come back, it's all gone. He'd left like a millimeter in each bottle, saying, well, at least I didn't finish it. So that was my brother. But when he left the army, the drinking got bad, and he was always leaving jobs just before they fired him. He'd show up on Monday smelling of booze, all that stuff. And of course, we were in complete denial about all of this. We just had a lot of euphemisms to kind of names for it. So he was rambunctious. He was a bit of a character. He was lively. He was a total alcoholic. We just couldn't see it that way at the time. And and when enough people had said to him, you keep losing these really nice girlfriends. If you're going to show up at the parents' house at 2 in the morning, drunk and wailing away, it works in a John Cusack movie, not this, and so he went and did a Tony Robbins weekend, and fair play to Tony Robbins. He walked across the hot coals and he came back sufficiently kind of transformed that he said, I'm going to stop drinking. And he stopped drinking, and it lasted about 18 months. And he got a nice new girlfriend, moved to Australia, and everything was going so well. After a year, he thought, well, I'll start drinking again. And as I learned in recovery, it's progressive. And so when he went off the wagon, he went off way worse than before, And so my starting life in my new house with my wife, suddenly the phone calls that two, three in the morning. My brother could never work out the time difference, you know. So, and it was garbled. I couldn't understand a word he was saying. And, you know, as they say, with all addictions, it's fun, then it's fun with problems, and then it's problems. And this is whatever the next stop is beyond that. This was not a happy person. And he had no memory of what he was doing. It's a miracle he didn't kill someone or got run over by a bus or whatever. So that was the first, you know, real family crisis. And the people I used to take to AA meetings said, well, you should try this thing called Al-Anon. So that's where I started. And that's where I heard my story, because I realized within three meetings, my dad was my main qualifier. I wasn't overly burdened with resentments about my brother, partly because, you know, we were thousands of miles apart at that point, which is a pretty good system, by the way. Pulling massive geographics buys you a couple of years. So I started going to Al-Anon meetings, and that's where I started sort of really uncovering the whole family tree of dysfunction. And so my dad, you know, my parents divorced when I was seven, and he started off Scottish and ended up Irish. So either way, being an alcoholic, you just blend into the, you know, native landscape. And I had quite honest conversations with my mother, I think in my 20s, you know, about what had happened and gone down. It was pretty bad. He was a, you know, Jekyll and Hyde drinker. He would disappear for 5 days at a time. Though she found a letter in his jacket from another woman. There was quite a lot of screwing around. And she said, don't go on the business trip, she'll be there. He went on the business trip, and while he was away, she, I think quite courageously, really, you know, sat down with a solicitor or a lawyer, and when he came back, sat him down. He came back drunk, lost his briefcase on the train, all that, you know, sat him down and said, I think, you know, we should divorce, which he accepted pretty, you know, didn't he was ready, you know, wasn't a happy drunk either. And he wound up marrying the other woman, who turned out to be just as much of an alcoholic as him. And so I had a dad one day and then gone, you know. And what made it complicated, because he was genial, but he was just a dependable alcoholic. So the one time he had to sort of pick us up for our 2 week vacation together, you know, he'd always be late, or he'd always, you know, that kind of thing. And that the I was lucky if he remembered half of our birthdays, that kind of stuff, you know. So there's just this constant yearning for some connection, that never quite came. And and I began my acting out as a kid really early. You know, I mean, you can almost see it in the school reports. Up until seven, I'm quite a well-behaved kid, and then as soon as I'm above seven, after seven, it's just I can't concentrate. I'm always pestering other people, and all the, you know, shoplifting and cigarettes and so on, all that sort of stuff, just secrets started to seep in. I always had to have some kind of fugitive thing going on that I couldn't admit, or I was just waiting to get caught, you know. And so begins my a classic ACA sort of addiction to false excitement and unnecessary secrets, and chaos and drama, and not being able to kind of deal with things directly, in between being quite competent. I think that's quite confusing for ACAs, is we're quite good at this, and then other things are completely just massively useless at. It's very inconsistent. And but the other sort of complication for me was I got a stepdad. So, and he was a good guy. He was a doctor, sort of lectured in medicine, things, very well-meaning, but massive temper. And he was an avowed pacifist. So of course my younger brother wound up going in the army. And but there was a total authoritarian. And so and I knew he meant well, but it was just, we had the household where my mother and my stepdad were both raging untreated Al-Anons. You know, the mood swings were complete roller coasters. So we'd have Christmases that, you know, the doors were slamming. My mom would retreat with a migraine for 3 days. There was just blow ups, and you know, we'd have a you could never get through any family vacation or gathering without some massive row, blow up thing where us kids would be sort of collateral damage, really. And we'd be waiting downstairs on Christmas Day for the parents to kind of, you know, get over it. And hug it out, you know. And I remember one vacation in France, we're all crammed into this car on some miserable camping trip, and it just, you know, they boiled over, and the car skids to a stop in the middle of some field in France. And my mom takes her kids, and my stepdad takes his kid, and then what? They both leave the car, just sort of like, what are we going to just walk across France? And I mean, just it took, you know, 6 hours to get it all back together again, so we could sort of continue on. And that was such a regular occurrence that the you just didn't invite anyone home. It's like you always, all of us wound up being much more comfortable at everyone else's house. It just didn't have the you weren't waiting for the other shoe to drop and that kind of thing. And of course, my way of asserting my identity as an inarticulate adolescent was just rebellion and defiance and fucking things up. So I was I went to a pretty sort of blue collar state school, and so by day I was this sort of working class hard nut, like, you know, trying to survive. And even the school looked like a gulag, like a, you know, brutalist concrete prison. And then at home I was a bit more middle class, so I had this sort of double life already like that. And you know, did lots of graffiti and bunking off school and things like that. And I got expelled by 14 because I must have been so bored pretending to be less clever than I was, because otherwise I get beaten up. Yeah, it's exactly the kind of school where you get beaten up for showing signs of intelligence or application in your homework. And I took a history book home and lovingly defaced this thing for a month, you know, with the rudest captions you can think of attached to Queen Victoria, whoever it was. I thought it was a satirical masterpiece, so much that I put it back in the pile at school in the library. And within a week it had come to the surface. And so the teacher, the teacher that hit you around the ear, he came and pulled out people, you and you know, the trying to find who had done it. And in the end they just invited my parents to the school to say, I you know, I'd be I should be better off elsewhere because I'd done this thing. And my parents, to their credit, protested, saying, well, how do you know it was sure? And the head teacher said, because it was witty and spelt correctly. And no one else was capable of these two things at the school. So I was deported off to actually a smarter school, but it was sort of too little, it was too much too late, rather. And I never quite caught up. And but also the depression was so great, you know, that just this weird thing of not being happy and no one being happy and it being exhausted because trying to manage the mood swings. And my stepfather died last year, and we put together obituary and things, and I discovered quite, I became to appreciate how much of an even bigger ACA he was than me. His own father was an absolute chronic alcoholic who had blown a family fortune, like quite a huge amount. I was just shocked to see how much it was. He had inherited this money because the older brother died training to be a pilot in the RAF. So he inherits this money at 21, doesn't know what to do with it, and invested it in communes, utopian communes in the, I think, the 1930s, which is a really bad business. No one makes any money investing in utopian co communes. And so my stepdad grew up with this father blowing through money. He was my stepfather's mother was put into a lunatic asylum when he was two, and he was told she was dead. And then at 20, he discovered she was alive. He had a sort of string of not necessarily very nice stepmothers, and was bringing up his own three half brothers, changing their diapers and stuff. He couldn't read it. He was 14. Someone rescued him at school, so he was fanatical about education because that had got him on track. And so that's why he was so dogmatic with us about education. And my mother was a teacher too, so this was a primary value in the household. And that's exactly what I rejected. In it, not even in a grand way. I just it was it it I didn't want anything to do with it, so I imploded my education at my own expense. Classic sort of self-sabotage, pointless victory where, ha, see, I showed them, and then I realized I've left school with no qualifications. So I, you know, worked as a cleaner and removals and bit of painting and that kind of thing. And just a miracle, really, that I found my way into Fleet Street journalism at the time, which was a kind of bit more of a open profession. So that saved me, because that I couldn't get into that profession now. But also the kind of ACA tricks of isolation and not asking for help. And these were the things that, when I made my way to ACA, my first meeting was 10 years ago, That's when I started to understand the threads of these things that were really affecting me as an adult had all begun, literally the coping mechanisms of all this chaos and dysfunction. And I remember trying to connect with my dad, thinking, well, and at 19, I went over as a sort of young man to start again. And he, like I say, he lived in Dublin, so I took the ferry over, and then of course he wasn't there to meet me. It was just like him picking us up from vacation. He wasn't there, so I tracked him down at his office, and he said, "Oh wait, is that today?" And of course, in my mind, it was the big trip where it was all going to be great, and for him, it was just whatever. So that didn't. There was no guidance there, and his, it was they were so out his my father and his second wife were so alcoholic daily, and they were almost geniuses. At each time they decided to drink each day, it would be a sort of spontaneous act, like they just thought of it, as opposed to actually their whole life was arranged around drinking. And their house was it's like a metaphor for the perfect alcoholic house, where the two front rooms were quite presentable, but the further you went into the house, the more it just nothing worked. And by the time you got to the kitchen at the back, it was like an absolute bombsite. The squalor was just shocking and shaming. I couldn't have, like no hinge on a cupboard could shut, and there was one ring on the gas thing, worked, and nothing got fixed. And I remember the shower that it was like the most begrudging trickle of lukewarm water. That was the shower, and this, and when I went back there 10, 20 years later, nothing had changed. They'd somehow just sort of this rickety thing where they were, all the things that should get fixed first never got fixed. And they had so many black trash bags of bottles in the little yard. I thought, oh, good for him, he's recycling. I thought he'd gone green. It's just, no, they just drank so much booze that they couldn't physically just sort of, get rid of the trash. And the at least he was genial, that you cling to things that are because obviously we hear quite tough stories, and so I was never physically abused or hit, and I was never mocked, I didn't get sarcasm, but just distance and secrets. And I think the denial that I was able to face once I started working ACA was fascinating. And I'll just a couple of vignettes to show you. So his second wife was, I guess, Catholic, and therefore had made no mention of him previously being married. So even though us kids would occasionally visit, it was never explained how we were connected. And so I had these two Irish half brothers who, when they were about 20, 21, they each took a trip to London and stayed with me for a week. And it was always on the both of them on the second night said, and you could see him plucking up the courage to ask, because this had just no one, this had never been said in the family. And they were like, "So, Sean, how are we related?" And I said, "Well, your father is my father. It's the same Ian, it's the same guy." And I would dig out a photo of him, when he was younger. And they were like, "Oh, I knew it, I knew it." He said, "I thought we were country cousins." I was like, "What the fuck's a country cousin? What are we, rednecks?" So it was never mentioned and never discussed. And I realized, at ACA, we've all of us had visited so many times without ever being introduced to a neighbor, another person. No one ever came around. It was always this weird little bubble of a visit where you didn't interact with the rest of their lives, and which is invisible shame. It's amazing, this sort of invisible force field of shame. And we all instinctively, I think, as sort of undiagnosed ACAs, instinctively knew. You just didn't mention it. You just didn't come up. You didn't confront the thing that was weird. It was like having a pebble in a shoe where you just adjusted the way you walked and got on with it, even though you look like Quasimodo. It just all became so familiar and normal. And and the one time I think my half brother asked my dad about how, he couldn't do it. He just stared at his plate. And sort of said, "Well, when I was at university, there was this other girl," and he just couldn't, it just was. Couldn't say it. And so my vignette of the denial was he drank and smoked so much, he had his first heart attack at 50, and he was going to come to London and stay with me. And of course, he didn't show up, and I waited till Monday before I finally called, because it just showed you how normal that was. And so I finally tentatively made a phone call saying, was he supposed to come on Friday? And his wife explained he'd had a heart attack and was in hospital. They hadn't thought to quite a serious one, and they just hadn't thought to contact us. So that was the level of emotional connection we had. and functionality. And but my favorite vignette was, so he gave up smoking after the first heart attack. She did not. And when I went to stay, she would smoke in the kitchen. And so me and my dad went in, I think we got some shopping or something, went to go in the kitchen, and she was clearly smoking while cooking on the one ring on the stove. And there was, and so he could see it. And rather than bust her, like, because she was supposed not to be smoking, he did this sort of weird abrupt U-turn. We went back out, made a bunch of noise to give her advance notice to put out the cigarette and wave away the smoke before we went back in. Of course, you go in, there's literally an atomic cloud across this tiny kitchen. There's like, the whole thing reeks of smoke. And we have to act like no one's been smoking in here. It was just, the perfect sort of illustration of denial. So my journey to recovery, the first bit was the Al-Anon stuff. And my brother, to his credit, got sober. I was very lucky. I found him a number in, he was down Australia. I found him a number in Sydney, which he lost. And that the and but stuck with it. And the thing I learned, which is really, I think, important, is, and I credit this to sort of Al-Anon as the beginning bit of learning recovery, was I learned to speak to him in a different way. And so the old exasperation with qualifiers, where you get mad, and swear at them, or say, "What's the matter with you?" or "What the fuck's the matter? Just stop. How hard is it to stop drinking for one day?" All the misunderstanding of what's actually going on with a alcoholic. The I learned quite quickly to detach from the problem, and the first sort of time I spoke to someone about how do I get my brother to stop drinking in recovery, and they said, "Well, you can't. That's his decision. That's nothing to do with you. You have to work on yourself." This is like, well, what's the point of the program? And they said, and it's like, no, you save yourself first. And there's a slow little ripple effect that leaves them room if they want to, but you've got to give them the dignity of their own decision. Otherwise, you will drive yourself crazy trying to manipulate and so on. So I have this sort of shtick I do, but we have this beautiful red book in ACA, as you can see, I'm holding it up, right? This gorgeous book that has every time you're feeling vague, down, confused, whatever, you just open a page and have a read and you find some wisdom. And then I have this other red book here, which, as you can see, is the smallest book known to man, but it's also a recovery book. This has no, and has no writing in it. And this one is How I Nag Them Sober. This thing, that book does not work, as I learned. So I talked to my brother in a different way. I said, "I'm going to these meetings, I'm finding them really interesting. I think our dad was an alcoholic, and I think you'll find them interesting." And that was it. But I was able to use the word alcoholic. And the first time I broke that, invisible sort of circle, and it's a bit like having one of those invisible shock collars on a dog. If you stray beyond the closed family system, and say these words out loud, you'll get zapped. And I did it, and I would have to drive to meetings 30 miles away in Pasadena so I could share all the embarrassing stuff, my dad being drunk, ripping the sink off the wall, peeing the bed, all the stuff that was just, I hadn't told anyone. And to be able to go and share that somewhere where then I thank God I'll never run into these people again. But I learned to trust the rooms. It was a really important thing. And I learned to, and I've never had anything come back at me of anything I've ever shared in a meeting, which is really great. And that's, 25 years of recovery in the rooms and things, so there is a sort of circle of trust, and it does work. And but for me, the sort of the key bit for in recovery was the first 3 years I just shared intellectually. I shared honestly. It was quite painful. It was very visceral. My heart would thump before I shared sometimes, things like that. Or I'd rehearse it obsessively. Someone once told me a perfect share, 3 minute share had to be like a perfect 3 minute pop song. It was just like way too much pressure. It's like, can I just share my rambling thoughts? It's like, is enough of a courageous act for today? A 3 minute pop song, So in my mind, I was like, well, I've got to craft the perfect recurring chorus of recovery. It's like, good luck, it wouldn't happen. And overthink it. And of course, the other thing is, you think you have nothing to say, and then when you started sharing, the real thing that you needed to share would come out. You just lots of discoveries you make. And I realized recovery is social. It's a cure for shame is always social and community. No one cures shame on their own and isolating. But the first 3 years was just intellectual. And so my wife and I had our first baby, and life moved on, and suddenly, had a kid that's about 18 months old. And I realized, oh, this is like having a miniature alcoholic. I know, this is so fascinating. They're really charismatic. They're playful and fun. They leave a trail of crap for you to clean up and never say thank you. It's like, I did all this. This is why this is so, fatherhood is a breeze, because I did all this with the fucking real alcoholics, you know? So, but at least, you know, babies, you got more chance of them growing up. Alcoholics, it's hit and miss. But it was when life was going well, and that's when my depression, adult depression, hit me in a way I just didn't know what to do with this. It was so visceral and heavy and so painful, and inexplicable. And I think there's something unhealed stuff in the psyche has to come up. And it's just pain is the, in the end, pain is the only thing that gets our attention, I think. Especially for me, because I had so much independence. I would not ask for any help. So when I was, before I actually sort of got halfway good jobs in my early 20s, I would be so broke that I'd have popcorn and tea was my diet for a weekend until like some dole check cleared, or I could, you know, borrow 10 quid off my sister or something. And I wouldn't ask anyone for help, you know. Amazing, I always had money for cigarettes. I don't know how that always works, but there, and but so I'd white knuckle it for like 3 days on popcorn and tea, rather than ask for help. That was too painful. And but learning to trust recovery and learning to ask people's help, whereas I'm confused about this. But anyway, I was so I, the depression took me down. And that's why my wife found me curled up on the floor in the afternoon, and she said, "Oh, honey, you have to go back to where you know, you felt better." And I thought she meant England. It's like, no. You don't need to go back to Al-Anon meetings, you know. That's just go to the. And of course, my comfort initially, I was very uneasy with mass all male meetings, and so I had these lovely, sweet old granny meetings in Brentwood where they made salad for lunch, and that was totally my speed. So I went back like a real man. I went back to the Blue Ridge grannies of Brentwood and got honest about my feelings, and that's why I let the spirituality in. I hadn't had that before, and opening up to the possibility of sort of the force of the universe, or how we're all connected, and you know, and you can look up the stars and it's limitless, you know. And the only other thing that's as limitless is the human soul. These are the two things that go on into infinity. We can't measure them, you know. So that humbled me enough to then start trusting in a higher power. And quite a big thing in the ACA literature is about discernment, which is a spiritual word, you know, being able to understand things with nuance, and from a deeper place. And that really changed my ability to process things and let things go, because it was no longer this hypervigilance, like trying to, you're not making a move until you figured out the 12, each of the 12 moves of the next chess move. You know, all that's exhausting, trying to mentally calculate everything. There's a big difference between compulsive and impulsive behaviors, controlling, manipulating in some way, or just, you know, game, and then spontaneity. And spontaneity, you always say the right thing. It always sort of, I don't know what I did, but I did the right thing. You know, I said the right thing. I knew exactly what to say without having to think about it. And we all have spontaneity when we're relaxed, you know. And when we're not relaxed, then it's more compulsive and impulsive. And so we are, you know, and that tends not to be the right thing, found. So that was all progress. And started working the steps and getting a sponsor and things like that. But you know, Alan and I reached a certain point where everyone was either sober or dead or in a different continent, you know. And at that moment, we have no one else to blame. And that, but my big ACA, and I kept being drawn to adult child meetings. I found them, you know, more and more interesting. And then ACA 10 years ago, and I kept going back to the ACA meetings. And that's where I started to connect really profoundly with the, you know, the Big Red Book, and the understanding of the inner child or the inner teenager, and what they didn't get, and what I can now give, and the process of reparenting. And the kind of there's always a sort of punchline to recovery stories, you know. So in my case, it was the my wife got sober 3 years ago last week, actually. And so it was like the call was coming inside the house, from inside the house. And I had, I didn't have denial, I just didn't have the, I kept thinking it would go away. I thought I'm managing it, but it will, you know. And the it was but and also I was very embarrassed about it. I could, even sharing it at meetings about it, I just, that was the, it was what I could talk about everyone else, but that was the one I just sort of, it just made me wince. Felt disloyal, It's weird, you know. And also, it's periodic. You know, again, dealing with alcoholics and addicts is very confusing because they have long periods where they don't use, don't drink. You know, everything seems fine. Then off you go again. You know, so and the so her bottom was pretty bad. I was out of the country. It was, you know, we had two daughters. It was, you know, and the distress, you know, dealing with a kid who's come back home to a dark house and mom's at a weird angle in the bed, the doors are open, and you know, all of it was just very distressing. But I used exactly the same thing I learned with my brother, which was, you know, don't get mad, don't scream and shout, don't, you know. And I knew enough to send a text saying, I know you're having a really hard time, because I had some bad news on a job I was trying to get, thought we had, and then didn't have. It was like a really nasty rug pull where I didn't get the job. And I just sent that text as, you know, we love you. We hope you know, can find your way to what you need. I know you're having a hard time and so on. And not words with 100% conviction when I sent it, 95% conviction. 5% of me was still like, and she did. She found, we have a place called Radford Hall down the hill in Sherman Oaks. And so she got on, you know, got on a bunch of Zoom meetings with the camera off, and just sort of did five or six Zoom meetings in a row that day. And like my brother, when she found her way to recovery, she was ready, you know. And so she's worked her AA program really diligently ever since. Which meant my last excuse for not really moving into being of service at ACA was gone. It was time for me to, you know, push my program to the next level. And of course, Radford Hall, they've had five or six Radford Halls over the last century in San Fernando Valley. So it started off on Radford, but they've been a bunch. So when I used to go, it was a musty church in a parking lot way out in the valley. And I remember you went into the parking lot and there was the musty church where all the meetings were. And then there was a bar called Tequila, spelt with a K, which I thought was a particularly cruel one last temptation of Christ move before you went to recovery, or you went to Tequila's with a K, and said, fuck it. And as we all know, those are the two words, no addict. You know, you never want to hear an addict say those two words, fuck it, because then they just go on a run. They can do whatever, you know. Whereas I think for ACAs or Al-Anons, we have three words, which is what the fuck? You walk in on the thing and you go, what the fuck? You know? So I learned not to say that and just say, I love you. I know you're having a hard time. I know you'll find your way to what you need. We're here for you, et cetera, et cetera. Huge maturity, trust me. And so she had gone to the meetings. By the time I got back from my trip, she had gone to a bunch of meetings in person, and she was saying me how nice Radford was. And I was like, wait, the musty church next to Tequila? She's like, no, there's a new one. They've got it together, and they've got a really lovely two rooms, speaker rooms. They have, you know, they have fancy high tech screens for Zoom meetings and the whole thing, and it's really nice. So again, one more excuse removed. So I went, and they have one ACA meeting a week. So I went in there, and it was just started, and they were just starting the yellow book and so on. And so I was sort of jumped in and said, I'm, you know, here I am. And then everyone else over the next 6 months left. I'm literally the elder of the village. It's like the last one standing. And but it, you know, but I've done it. I've done every position going around, you know, a couple of times. And and we're thriving, you know what I mean? It's like, it's really nice to see people coming in. And there's a moment where I was like, now that I've done the steps enough time, I've done Zoom groups where I've helped people do the steps. And so this is the plug for the for anyone who hasn't done the steps. You know, the whole thing about you come to meetings to feel better, absolutely. But then my sponsor would say to me, well, if you have problems, share them with me or other people. But when you go to a meeting, share your recovery. That will keep you on track. And I thought, well, that's not bad advice. Unless you have a, you know, unless you have a burning problem. So the yellow book, you know, the 12 steps of ACA, is a beautifully written book. And I'm a picky writer, I'm a snob, you know. So, but it's like, this is the stuff is really beautifully phrased and very what's the word? It's like when you're looking for that sort of consolation of the spirit, you know, there you find the wisdom in here. And the process of working the steps, each time I've done it quite a few times, and each time you just come at yourself from a different angle. There's another sort of layer or perspective on it, and or another memory, you know, because one of the things of ACA that's unique to ACA is this full remembrance, to, you know, so we're imprisoned by childhood reactions no longer. And I remember being so bewildered with myself in my 50s. I'm 61 now. And it was like, why do I I remember sort of saying it, and I was like, I literally feel like a 7-year-old. I feel like a terrified 7-year-old. This is ridiculous. I'm an intelligent person. What's the matter? Why am I being hijacked by this? And of course, that's the one thing in ACA where it's like you're imprisoned by childhood reactions. The very thing, the traumas and things that are sort of lodged in the psyche, that's the stuff that needs to come to the surface and be remembered to feel it, to heal it in a safe place. That's the difference. The structure of ACA provides that. Trying to do it on your own or trying to do it, talk with civilians about stuff where they just look at you like you're crazy and have no idea what you're talking about. And then you come, the beautiful thing, with the rooms is you come and share your stuff and everyone nods, they like, yeah, and that feeling of you're not the only one. And I love the thing where whatever the worst thing about an alcoholic qualifier I could share, there was always some sweet old lady would come up to me afterwards and say, oh, that's nothing. They said, my husband, he'd drink a liter and a nearly 2 liters of vodka a night and crap his pants. And I would take pictures of him with them and throw the Polaroids at him the next morning and say, am I lying? Am I lying? I was like, thank you. That's just what I needed to hear. Like whatever you've done, there's always someone that, where they've had it worse, and we're not alone. And it's a beautiful feeling for that side of things. So, but the process of doing the steps, well, two observations I found. One was, the anecdotes are in italics, so you don't need to read the italics if you do a Yellow Book meeting. You just need, that's your homework, you stick to that stuff, otherwise it takes quite a lot, takes too long really. And the first three steps, we all know this tango, 1 2 3, 1 2 3, and then you get to the fourth step, and what the group would say, start with 18 people, and then you get to the fourth step and you look around. You remember the scene in Animal House where John Belushi says, let's go, and he charges and then no one follows. And every time you do the fourth step, I felt like John Belushi. I look around, it's like, where have everyone? Everyone was busy. They were ill. They had this, they had that. There's like, they're literally physically, there's so much resistance to facing the fourth step, which is all the childhood stuff. But if you all hold hands and jump together, as it were, then you get through it. And the other thing I noticed is when the ones who stuck with it, worked it through, it didn't have to be perfect. You can just write a one word answer, no, yes, or I don't know, I'll come back to this. You just keep moving through the steps. And the change in energy, they wouldn't notice it, but I wouldn't notice it. And by the sort of they when they do the process of an amends, and when you discover self-forgiveness is possible in ACA. In fact, it's not, it's the design of the program is so you arrive at self-forgiveness and a clean slate. And you don't have to carry this stuff with you. And the difference in the energy was phenomenal. Suddenly it was like, oh yeah, I've started this improv class and I've been doing these dancing things again. I haven't done that in 20 years. And this lightness and playfulness had returned to people that, where they'd been so stuck. And that was me, obviously. I was the same thing, but it's just nice to see it with other people where they, could blossom and go forward. And then getting those people who once they've done the steps to come and do a lead share, start off with a 5, 10 minute, 15 minute, it's like being a stand-up comedian, you gotta do work in your material, then you're a middle, then you move on up to being a headliner with the full show. And but I keep trying to push myself too in that sense. So I put myself on the list. They have a ACA speaker list. So I was like, I'm just, if I'm asked, I'm gonna say yes. I'm not gonna say no, I'm gonna do it. And so I work my way out and do the full lead chair. And but this year I had a new one, which was I got a request from a prison, woman's prison, to go and do a lead chair. Absolutely fascinating. Never been, I don't think I've even been inside a prison. And went down to the women's prison in LA. And it was really, it was a lesson, because 50 women in, yellow jumpsuits sit in the central area. And I look around, I was like, whatever shtick I had in my mind evaporated. Like you're looking at people who are beaten down and they're looking at you like, what have you got for me? And you realize I can't wing this. There's no wing. I have to just be completely honest about stuff, And that was great. It was like no bullshit. Tell your story. And what was interesting was the reactions when I was telling the stuff. I mean, they love humor. They need humor, So and that the but when I told them that my brother had got sober and stayed sober, massive round of applause. And then when I said my wife had got sober, massive round of applause. They needed hope so much. They needed to know there was a way out of it. And these were people who'd been separated from kids. I mean, just the violence, the stuff they'd gone through was, it was just unimaginable to me. And whatever woes I thought I had were nothing compared to a system that basically punishes you for being poor, not having a bit of driving insurance, or having a violent boyfriend or something like that. It's a rough deal, rough deal. And but they took books, they took the books and things, and it was a real sort of moment where like it just spreading the message for people who want it. You can't force anyone, but if it's there and it's the breadcrumbs out of the forest, if they want to follow them, they can, sort of thing. So that was the sort of very gratifying thing for this year. And the is that my is that 5 minutes or 15 minutes left? Sorry, 5 minutes left. Thank you. Thanks, Adam. So I'll just wrap up with the sort of close of the thing. So my dad died 17 years ago, in a pub on St. Patrick's Day with a pint in his hand, watching the rugby. Over he went, and so he, there was I had the brother who got sober and the dad that didn't, and the irony was when his wife died a couple of years ago, they said, oh, she didn't start drinking until she met him, so it was like, what do they call it, a folie à deux. And but he phoned me the day before he died, phoned all us three kids the day before he died. He knew something. He knew to get in under the wire. And we all at the funeral, we said, did he have a strange call? It's like, yeah, we all had it, where it was instead of the normal sort of superficial, hi, how are the kids, whatever, and then that would be it, really. There was a pause, and then he said, I thought a lot about you, and you've been in a profession that I know a bit about. It's tough, and you've made your way in the world, isn't that? And I'm really proud of you, and I love you, and blah, blah, blah. He said the things that none of us had ever heard. We'd never heard from him. And first thing was, where the fuck was this 40 years ago? And I would have loved to have heard this. This would have made such a difference when I was fucking up. The hand on the shoulder, like, it's okay, you screwed up. We'll go and say we're sorry. We'll clean up the, whatever the guidance that wasn't there. So good for him. And I know, in his own way, he had a tough time. His dad was a prisoner of war during World War II, so he didn't even have a dad for 5 years. So context and understanding and forgiveness. And my stepdad was the complete opposite, because we whatever bust ups we had had, we worked our way through it. And I remember the closest I was with him was when we went to clean out his father's cottage, where he'd hidden all the whiskey bottles. There were 27 whiskey bottles hidden around his little cottage. And that was my bonding experience with my stepdad, who in many ways was an even bigger ACA than I ever was, but we, thanks to recovery and my mom getting her little recovery books and everything else, we got to talk about all this stuff. So when he died of cancer, and but it was like a year of saying goodbye, and I would go and visit. And I remember the last time I saw him, I sat on the bed, held his hand, very papery skin, this and but we got to say the things, and we were close, and he could talk about all his history and everything else. And it was a meaningful goodbye rather than a mystery that had to be, resolved with my dad. And that the it doesn't it's still all us kids who survived all this, we still, when we meet, look at each other and have that thing where, like, I wasn't crazy, was I? It was a complete shit show. And we all nod and go, no, it was a total shit show, our childhood. But we all came through it with, with a lot of humor. So that, brings, and then life goes on, right? So it's like the I have two kids, they have their stuff. One of them, funny enough, has a friend who's a blackout drinker at college, and so it's like, how do you navigate that without turning into a complete codependent tango, and I always resort to my, forbearing mode. Well, I know it's tough, and these things are tough, and blah, blah, blah. Trust you to work it out and so on. But they qualify. It's the other thing, is like, your kids qualify for what's it, by virtue of being your kids, they're already pre-qualified for recovery programs too. But I tell you what, in the end, the thing that's nice is the connection I found in ACA, in the meetings, in the rooms, and on Zooms, is I did not, for so many years now, and I did not know ACA existed. And ACA gave me the key to unlock the traumas, and all the bad habits and coping, misguided coping behaviors of childhood. And I'm just in a such a healthier, more grateful place today than when I was sitting in a car thinking, well, if I drive fast enough into that wall, could I commit suicide in one go, and thank God I had kids, because that was the only thing that stopped me from, that's how low I got and how off track I got. And the with ACA now, I just work my program every day. I read my Strengthening My Recovery every day. It's the, it starts the day with everything and finishes the day too. So And I love hearing people's stories in return. I think it's such a great exchange, this sort of honesty in a safe place. And it's a beautiful program, and it's been a pleasure to be able to talk to you. And thanks for letting me share.